Sleep. The single word rose in his battered mind like a flame in a dark room. Sleep. To lie down and shut out the noise, the fear, the unceasing misery. Sleep. He reached the top of the gentle slope, then tipped himself over and slithered downhill. All his senses were bent on the cool, white fog lying at the bottom of the depression. As he crawled through the outlying layer of mist, the roar of the guns did seem to grow less. Although the world still shuddered, he struggled forward until the fog closed above his head, shutting out the darts of red light crossing the sky. He was completely surrounded in cool whiteness. The hammering in his head quieted. He slowed. Something lay before him in the murk. More than one thing. Dark, oblong shapes scattered along the slope. He dragged himself forward, eyes painfully wide and smarting with dirt, trying to see what they were. Coffins. Dozens of coffins were strewn along the hillside, some protruding from the sheared mud like ships breasting a wave. Many had spilled their occupants. Pale winding sheets trailed down the shallow slope as though the coffin owners, too, were fleeing the war. The guns still boomed, but they were strangely muted. Paul drew himself into a crouch, staring, and something like sanity began to come back. This was a graveyard. The ground had fallen away, revealing an old burial ground, its markers long since smashed to flinders. The dead had been spat out by an earth now surfeited with death. Paul pushed himself deeper into the fog. These corpses were now as homeless as those of his brothers above, 100 tragic stories that would go unheard in the clamor of mass mortality. Here a mummified head sagged above the mud-spattered whiteness of a bridal dress, jaw dangling as though its owner called to the groom who had left her alone at death's altar. Nearby, a small skeletal hand protruded from beneath the lid of a tiny coffin. Baby had learned to say bye-bye. Paul's sobbing laughter almost choked him. Death was everywhere, in uncountable variety. This was the Grim Reaper's wonderland, the Dark One's private park. One sprawled skeleton wore the uniform of an earlier army, as though it crawled toward the muster bugle of the present conflict. A rotted winding sheet revealed 2 mummified children wrapped together, mouths round holes like hymn-singing angels on a sentimental card, old and young, big and small. The civilian corpses had been cast forth in a macabre democracy to join the foreign strangers dying in throngs above, all to pass together into the blending mud. Paul struggled on through the foggy village of dead. The sounds of war grew more distant, which drove him ever forward. He would find a place where the conflict did not penetrate. Then he would sleep. A coffin at the edge of the ditch caught his eye. Dark hair trailed from it and wavered in the wind like the fronds of some deep-sea plant. The lid was gone, and as he crawled nearer he could see the face of its female occupant nestled in the winding sheet, curiously undecayed. Something about her bloodless profile made him pause. He stared. Quivering, he approached the coffin, laying his hands on the muddy box so he could draw himself up to crouch above it. His hand pulled down the decaying muslin. It was her. Her. The angel of his dreams. Dead in a box. Wrapped in a stained shroud and lost to him forever. His insides contracted. For a moment he thought he might fall into himself, shrink into nothingness like straw in a flame. Then she opened her eyes. Black. Black and empty. And her pale lips moved.
"Come to us, Paul."
He shrieked and leaped up, but caught his foot on the coffin handle and tumbled face first back into the mud. He scrambled away, thrashing through the clinging muck like a wounded beast. She did not rise or follow, but her quiet, summoning voice trailed him through the fog until his own blackness swallowed him. He was in a strange place, stranger than any he had yet seen. It was nothing, the truth of no man's land. Paul sat up, feeling curiously numb. His head still throbbed with the echoes of battle, but he was surrounded by silence. He wore a coating of mud inches thick, but the ground on which he lay was neither wet nor dry, neither hard nor soft. The fog through which he had crawled had thinned, but he could see nothing in any direction except pearl-white nothingness. He rose on trembling legs. Had he escaped? The dead angel. The village of coffins. Had those been a shell-shocked dream? He took a step. Then a dozen more. Everything remained as it was. He expected to see recognizable shapes appear through the mist at any moment. Trees, rocks, houses. But the emptiness seemed to move with him. After what seemed an hour of fruitless walking, he sat down and wept. Weak tears of exhaustion and confusion. Was he dead? Was this purgatory? Or worse, for one could at least hope to work one's way out of purgatory, was this where one went after death, to stay? Help me! There was no trace of an echo. His voice went flatly out and did not return. Help me, someone! He sobbed again. What have I done? No answer came. Paul curled up on the knot ground and pressed his face into his hands. Why had the dreams brought him to this place? The angel had seemed to care for him. But how could kindness lead to this? Unless every man's death was kind, but every man's afterlife was unremittingly bleak, Paul clung to the self-inflicted dark. He could not bear to see the mist anymore. The angel's pale face appeared to his mind's eye, not cold and empty as it had been in the plundered graveyard, but the sweetly mournful visage that had haunted his dreams for so long. Was it all madness? Was he even here in this place at all? Or was his body lying in the bottom of the muddy trench, or beside the other failures in the morgue of a field hospital? Slowly, almost without his conscious attention, his hand stole across his muddy uniform blouse. As it reached his breast pocket, he suddenly knew what he himself sought. He stopped, terrified to move farther, for fear of what he might discover. But there is nothing else left. His hand dipped into the pocket and closed around it. When he opened his eyes, then brought it out into the dim light, it shimmered, iridescent green. It was real. As Paul stared at the feather clutched in his fist, something else began to shimmer, not far away, or what seemed in this unfathomable place not far away. The fog smoldered with a light like molten gold. He scrambled to his feet, fatigue and injuries almost forgotten. Something, a kind of doorway or hole, was forming in the mist. He could see nothing within its circumference but shifting amber light that moved like oil on water. Yet he knew with a sudden, unshakable certainty that there was something on the other side. It led to somewhere else. He stepped toward the golden glow. "What's your hurry, Jonesy? Yes, you wouldn't run off without telling your mates, would you?" Paul stopped, then slowly turned. Coming forward out of the blanketing mist were two shapes, one large, one small. He saw something glint on one of the dim faces. Finch? Mullet? The big one honked a laugh. We've come to show you the way home. The terror that had dissipated now came flooding back. He took a step nearer to the golden glow.
Don't do that!
Finch said sharply. When he spoke again, his tone was softer.
Come on, old mate. Don't make it harder on yourself. If you come back peaceful-like, well, it's just shell-shock. Maybe you'll even get a little time in hospital to pull yourself together.
I don't want to come back.
Desertion, is it?
Mullet came nearer. He seemed bigger than before, immensely round and strangely muscled. His mouth wouldn't close all the way because there were too many teeth.
Oh, that's very bad. Very bad indeed.
Be reasonable, Jonesy.
Finch's spectacles threw back the light, obscuring his eyes.
Don't throw it all away. We're your friends. We want to help you.
Paul's breath grew short. Finch's voice seemed to pull at him.
But I know you've had a bad time,
the small man said.
You've been confused. Felt like you were going mad, even. You just need rest. Sleep. We'll take care of you.
He did need rest. Finch was right. They would help him. Of course they would. His friends. Paul swayed, but did not retreat as they came nearer. The golden glow flickered behind him, growing dimmer.
Just give me that thing in your hand, old mate.
Finch's voice was soothing. And Paul found himself holding the feather out to him.
That's right. I'll sit here.
The golden light grew fainter, and the reflection on Finch's spectacles grew fainter, too, so that Paul could see through the lenses. Finch had no eyes.
No!
Paul staggered back a step and raised his hands.
Leave me alone!
The two figures before him wavered and distorted, Finch growing even leaner and more spidery, Mullet swelling until his head disappeared down between his shoulders.
You belong to us!
Finch shouted. He looked nothing like a man any longer. Paul Jonas clutched the feather tightly, turned, and jumped into the light. Chapter 7 The Broken String. Netfeed News. Fish killer feared in Pacific. Visual, Scottish fisherman in port, emptying nets. V.L. The dinoflagellate parasite responsible for the North Atlantic die-off that killed hundreds of millions of fish a decade ago has reappeared in mutated form in some Pacific Ocean spawning grounds. Visual, dead fish with severely ulcerated skin. UN authorities fear that this version of the organism may be resistant to the laboratory-constructed virus with which the dinoflagellate's reign of terror was halted last time. Stephen lay motionless, sunk in the smeary depths of the plastic tent like a fly entombed in amber. He had tubes in his nose, his mouth, his arms. He looked, Rini thought, as though he were slowly becoming part of the hospital. Another machine, another appliance. She clenched her fists hard, fighting the swell of despair. Khabu put his hands into the gloves attached to the tent wall, then looked up at her, asking permission. All she could do was nod her head. She did not trust herself to speak.
"He is very far away,"
the little man whispered. It was strange to see his light-skinned bushman features peering from behind a plastic faceplate. Rini felt a pang of fear for him, a sudden spike that punched through even the misery of seeing her brother's unchanged state. VR. Quarantine. Every new experience she gave Khabu seemed to demonstrate another way not to touch. Would it all sicken him? Was his spirit already weakening? She pushed the thought away. Khabu was the sanest, most well-grounded person she knew. She was worrying because her brother and her friend were much the same size, and both were sealed away behind layers of plastic. It was her own helplessness pulling at her. She moved forward and touched Khabu's shoulder with her gloved hand. In a way, since he was touching Stephen, she was touching her brother also. Khabu's fingers traced the lines of Stephen's sleeping face, their movements careful and precise in a way that suggested doing something rather than merely feeling, then moved down his neck to his breastbone.
"He is very far away," he said again. "It is like a powerful medicine trance." "What's that?"
Khabu did not reply. His hands remained on Stephen's chest, just as hers stayed on the little man's shoulder. For long moments, all the parts of the small human chain were still. Then Rini felt a gentle motion. Within the baggy confines of the ensuit, Khabu had begun to sway. Gentle sounds, like the sonorous hum and click of insects in tall grass, rose and mixed with the mechanical noises of life support. After a few seconds, she realized that Khabu was singing. The little man was silent as they left the hospital. At the bus stop, he remained standing when Rini sat down, staring at the passing cars as though looking for an answer to some difficult question in the patterns of traffic. "A medicine trance is not easy to explain," he said. "I have been to city schools. I can tell you what they say, a self-induced hypnotic state, or I can tell you what I grew up with in the Okavango swamps, that the medicine man has gone to a place where he can talk with the spirits, even the gods." He closed his eyes and was quiet for a time, as though preparing for some trance state of his own. At last he opened his eyes again and smiled. "The more I learn of science, the more I respect the mysteries of my people." A bus pulled up and disgorged a weary-looking group of passengers, who all seemed to hobble, shuffle, or limp as they made their way up the ramp toward the hospital. Rini squinted at the bus until she located the route number. It was not the one they wanted. Obscurely angry, she turned away. She felt unsettled, like the sky before a storm.
"If you mean that science is useless, I can't agree with you. Unless you're talking about medical science, that is. Bloody worthless."
She sighed.
"No, that's not fair."
Khabu shook his head.
"I do not mean that at all, Rini. It is hard to express. I suppose it is that the more things I read about the discoveries of scientists, the more I respect what my people already know. They have not come to these understandings in the same ways, in closed laboratories, and with the help of thinking machines. But there is something to be said for a million years of trial and error, especially in the swamps or the Kalahari Desert, where instead of just spoiling an experiment, a mistake is likely to kill you."
What understandings are you talking about?
The wisdom of our parents, grandparents, ancestors. In each individual life, it seems, we must first reject that wisdom, then later come to appreciate it.
His smile returned, but it was small and thoughtful.
"As I said, it is hard to explain. And you look tired, my friend."
Rini sat back.
"I am tired, but there's lots to do."
She moved, trying to find a comfortable position on the molded plastic bench. Whoever made them seemed to intend the things for something other than sitting. No matter how you arranged yourself, you were never quite comfortable. She gave up and slid forward to perch on the edge, then pulled out a cigarette. The flame tab was defective, and she wearily groped in her bag for her lighter.
What were you singing? Did it have something to do with the medicine trance?
Oh, no! He seemed mildly scandalized, as if she had accused him of a theft.
No, it was merely a song, a sad song made by one of my people. I sang it because I was unhappy seeing your brother lost and wandering so far from his family.
Tell me about it. Habu let his brown eyes drift to the crush of traffic once more.
It is a song of mourning for the loss of a friend. It is about the string game, too. Do you know it?
Weenie held up her fingers in an imaginary cat's cradle. Habu nodded.
I do not know if I can make the exact words in English. Something like this. There were people, some people, who broke the string for me, and so this place is now a sad place for me, because the string is broken. The string broke for me, and so this place does not feel to me as it used to feel, because the string is broken. This place feels as if it stood open before me, empty, because the string has broken. And so, this place is an unhappy place, because the string is broken.
He fell silent. Because the string broke for me, Rini repeated. The quietness of the sorrow, its very understatement, made her own feelings of loss come rushing up inside her. 4 weeks. A full month now. Her baby brother had been sleeping for a month, sleeping like the dead. A sob shook her body, and tears forced their way out. She tried to push the misery back, but it would not be suppressed. She wept harder. She tried to speak, to explain herself to Habu, but couldn't. To her embarrassment and horror, she realized she had lost control, that she was having a helpless crying fit on a public bus bench. She felt naked and humiliated. Habu did not put his arms around her, or tell her over and over that things would be fine, that everything would work out. Instead, he seated himself beside her on the smooth plastic seat and took her hands in his, then waited for the storm to pass. It did not pass quickly. Every time Rini thought it was over, that she had regained control over her emotions, another convulsion of misery broke across her and set her weeping again. Through tear-blurred eyes, she saw another busload of passengers delivered to the curb. Several stared at the tall, weeping woman being comforted by a little bushman in an antique suit. The idea of how odd she and Habu must look tripped her up. Soon she was laughing as well, although the weeping had not stopped or even weakened. A small, separate part of her, that seemed to hover somewhere in the center of the maelstrom, wondered if she would ever stop, or if she would instead be stuck here like a hung program, switching back and forth from hilarity to grief until the sky grew dark and everyone went home. At last it ended. More from fatigue than any recovery of control, Weenie noted with disgust, Habu released her hands. She could not look at him yet, so she reached into her coat pocket and found a crumpled piece of tissue she had used earlier to blot her lipstick, then did her best to dry her face and wipe her nose. When she did meet her friend's eyes, it was with a kind of defiance, as though daring him to take advantage of her weakness. "Is the sadness less painful now?" She turned away again. He seemed to think it was perfectly natural to make an idiot of yourself out in front of the Durban outskirt medical facility. Maybe it was. The shame had already diminished, and was now only a faint, reproving voice at the back of her mind. "I'm better," she said. "I think we missed our bus." Habu shrugged. Weenie leaned over and took his hand in hers and squeezed it just for a moment. "Thank you for being patient with me." His calm brown eyes made her nervous. What was she supposed to do? Be proud of herself for breaking down?
One thing in that song.
Yes, he was watching her carefully. She couldn't understand why, but she couldn't take the scrutiny. Not now. Not with swollen eyelids and a running nose. She looked down at her own hands, now safely back in her lap.
Where it said, there were people, some people who broke the string for me. Well, there are people. There must be.
Habu blinked. I do not understand.
Stephen isn't just sick. I don't believe that anymore. In fact, I never really believed it, although I could never make sense out of the feeling. Someone, some people, like in the song, did this to him. I don't know who or how or why, but I know it.
Her laugh was strained.
I guess that's what all the crazy people say. I can't explain it, I just know it's true.
You think this because of the research? Because of what we saw in the library? She nodded, straightening up. She felt strength coming back. Action. That was what was needed. Crying was useless. Things had to be done.
That's right. I don't know what it means, but it has something to do with the net.
But you said the net is not a real place, that what happens there is not real. If someone eats there, it does not nourish them. How could something on the net cause an injury? Send a young child into a sleep from which he will not wake?
I don't know, but I'm going to find out.
Rini suddenly smiled at how the most critical times in your life always threw you back onto clichés. That was the kind of thing people said in detective stories. It had probably been said at least once in the book she was reading to Stephen.
She stood. I don't want to wait for another bus, and I'm sick of this bench. Let's go get something to eat. If you don't mind, I mean. You've wasted a whole day on me and my problems already. What about your work for class?
Khabu showed her his sly grin. I work very hard, Miss Sulawayo. I have already completed this week's assignments.
Then come with me. I need food and coffee, especially coffee. I'll leave my father to fend for himself. It will do him good.
As she set off down the sidewalk, she felt lighter than she had for weeks, as though she had thrown off a soaking garment.
There must be something we can learn, she said. All problems have solutions. You just have to work at them.
Khabu did not reply to this, but sped his pace to keep up with her longer strides. The gray afternoon warmed as points of glowing orange bloomed all around them. The streetlights were beginning to come on.
Hello, Mutsi. May we come in, please?
Eddie's mother stood in the doorway, looking from Rini to Khabu with a mixture of interest and suspicion.
What do you want?
I want to talk to Eddie.
What for? Did he do something?
I just want to talk to him.
Rini was beginning to lose her temper, which would not be a good way to start.
Come on, you know me. Don't keep me standing at your door like a stranger.
Sorry. Come inside.
She stepped aside to let them pass, then indicated the slightly concave sofa covered with a brightly colored throw rug. Rini nudged Khabu toward it. Not that there would be anywhere else to sit. The apartment was as cluttered as the night Stephen had gotten ill.
Probably the same clutter,
Rini thought, then chided herself for mean-spiritedness.
The boy's taking a bath.
Mutsi didn't offer to bring them anything, and didn't sit down herself. The moment hung awkwardly. Eddie's two sisters lay prostrated like worshippers in front of the wall screen, watching two men in brightly colored jumpsuits floundering in a vat of some sticky substance. Mutsi kept looking at it over her shoulder. She clearly wanted to sit down and watch.
I'm sorry about Stephen, she said at last. He's a good boy. How is he?
Just the same.
Rini heard the tightness in her own voice.
The doctors don't know. He's just asleep.
She shook her head, then tried to smile. It wasn't Mutsi's fault. She wasn't a great mother, but Rini didn't think what happened to Stephen had anything to do with that.
Maybe Eddie could come with me sometime to see him. The doctor said it would be good for him to hear familiar voices.
Mutsi nodded her head, but looked uncertain. A moment later, she went into the hallway.
Eddie! Hurry up, boy! Stephen's sister wants to talk to you!
She emerged, shaking her head, as though she had performed a difficult and thankless task.
He stay in there for hours. Sometimes I look around and say, where is that boy? Is he dead or something?
She stopped herself. Her eyes grew round.
Sorry, Irene.
Rini shook her head. She could almost feel Khabu's eyebrow lifting. She had never told him her real name.
It's okay, Mutsi. Oh, and I didn't introduce Khabu. He's my student. He's helping me do some research to see if we can find out something about Stephen's condition.
Mutsi cast an eye across the bushman on her sofa.
What do you mean, research?
I'm trying to see if there's something the doctors missed. Some article in a medical magazine. Something.
Rini decided to leave it there. Mutsi had no doubt already made up her mind who and what Khabu was to Rini. Suggesting that they were trying to find out whether the net might have made Stephen ill would only make the story sound even more feeble.
I just want to do everything I can.
Mutsi's attention was drawn to the wall screen again. Two men, covered with sticky ooze, were now trying to climb the sides of a rocking, transparent vat.
Of course, she said. You do everything you can.
Rini reflected on the worth of this wisdom. Coming from a woman who had once sent her children on the bus to her sister's house for the weekend without remembering that her sister had moved across Pinetown, Rini knew because the children had fetched up on her own doorstep and she had wasted an entire weekend afternoon tracking down the aunt's new address and delivering them to it. Oh, yes, Mutsi. You and me. We do everything we can. Eddie appeared from the back, hair wet and close to his head, wearing a pair of striped pajamas that were far too big. The cuffs, rolled several times, still dragged on the floor. His head was held low, as though he anticipated a whipping.
Come in here, boy. Say hello to Irene.
Hello, Rini. Hello, Eddie. Sit down, will you? I want you to answer some questions for me.
People from the hospital asked him all kinds of questions already,
Mutsi said over her shoulder. She sounded almost proud.
Some man come. He took the food out of the refrigerator. Made notes.
I have other things I want to ask about. Eddie, I want you to think very carefully before you answer me, okay? He looked to his mother, begging her further intervention, but she had already turned back to the wall screen. Eddie sat down on the floor in front of Rini and Khabu. He plucked one of his little sister's action figures from the threadbare carpet and began to twist it in his hands. Rini explained who Khabu was, but Eddie didn't seem too interested. Rini remembered how she had felt in these situations at the same age, that adults were to be considered part of a shapeless enemy mass until proven otherwise. I don't blame you for anything, Eddie. I'm just trying to find out what happened to Stephen. He still wouldn't look up.
He's sick.
I know that, but I want to find out what made him that way.
We didn't do anything. I told you that.
Not that night, maybe. But I know you and Stephen and Soki were messing around on the net, going places you shouldn't go. I know, Eddie. Remember?
Yeah. He shrugged.
So tell me about it.
Eddie twisted at the doll in his hands until Rini worried that he might pull it apart. The damn things were expensive, and she ought to know, having supplied Stephen with more net surfer detectives figures than she wished to count. Masker was particularly prone to damage, since he had a fragile, arch-exotic plastic hairstyle at least half his own height.
Everybody else did it, he said at last. We told you. Just tapping and napping.
Everybody else did what? Got into Inner District?
Yeah.
What about that place, Mr. J's? Does everybody go there, too?
Yeah. Well, not everybody. A lot of the older guys talk about it.
Rini sat back, giving up on her attempt to force eye contact.
And a lot of them are probably lying. What have you heard about the place that made you want to go there?
What kind of place is this?
Khabu asked.
Not very nice. It's on the net. A virtual club like that place I took you is a virtual cafe.
She turned back to Eddie.
What do the older kids say about it?
That you can see stuff there. Get stuff.
He looked over at his mother, and even though she seemed enthralled with the two sticky men smacking each other with long glowing poles, he fell silent. Rini leaned forward.
What stuff? Damn it, Eddie, I need to find out.
Guys say that you can feel things, even if you don't have the flack.
Flack?
A new netboy term. They changed so quickly.
The stuff so you can touch what's on the net.
Tactors? Sensory receptors?
Yeah, the good stuff. Even if you don't have it, there's things in Mr. J's you can feel. And there's, I don't know, guys say all kinds of...
He trailed off again.
Tell me what they say.
But Eddie was clearly uncomfortable talking to an adult about backroom netboy gossip. This time it was Rini who turned to Eddie's mother for help. But Mutsi had relieved herself of responsibility and was not going to take it back. Several other lines of questioning produced little new information. They had gone into the club in search of some of these whispered-about experiences, and to see things. Rini assumed it was pornography of some kind, either sex or violence, but had instead gotten lost, and wandered for hours through Mr. J's. Parts of it had been very frightening and disorienting, others just interestingly weird, but Eddie claimed he could remember little of what they had actually seen. At last, some men, including an unpleasant fat man, or a sim that looked like one, sent them downstairs to a special room. Soki had fallen into some kind of trap, and the other two had somehow escaped and called Rini.
And you can't remember any better than that? Even if it might help Stephen get better again?
For the first time all evening, the boy met and held Rini's gaze.
I'm not dupping.
Lying, she explained to Khabu. I didn't say you were, Eddie. But I'm hoping you can remember a little better. Please try.
He shrugged. But now that she could see his eyes clearly, she saw something elusive in his gaze. Was she sure he was telling the truth? He seemed frightened, and they were long past the point when he should have feared punishment from Rini.
Well,
If you remember anything else, call me. Please, it's very important.
She got up from the couch. Eddie started to move toward the hallway. Head down again.
One other thing,
she said.
What about Soki?
Eddie turned to look at her. Eyes wide.
He got sick. He's at his aunt's. I know.
Did he get sick because of what happened when you were on the net together?
Tell me, Eddie.
He shook his head.
I don't know. He didn't come back to school.
Weenie surrendered.
Go on.
Eddie, like a cork held underwater and then finally released, almost sprang from the room. Weenie turned to Mutzi, who lay on the carpet beside her daughters.
Do you have Soki's aunt's number?
Mutzi clambered to her feet, sighing heavily, as though she had been asked to carry several hundredweight of stone up the Drakensberg Mountains.
Maybe it's around here somewhere.
Weenie looked at Khabu to share her exasperation, but the little man was staring at the wall screen in reluctant fascination, watching one of the sticky men trying to catch, kill, and eat a live chicken. The sound of audience laughter, captured and processed until it echoed like the roar of machinery, filled the small room. The last classes of the day were being released into the halls. Weenie watched the kaleidoscopic movement of color across the office windows as she reflected on human beings and their need for contact. Back at the end of the previous century, people had been predicting that school would be uniformly taught over video links, or even that teachers might be replaced entirely by interactive teaching machines and hypertext info banks. Of course, people had been wrong about that sort of thing before. Weenie remembered something one of her university instructors had told her. When they marketed frozen food 100 years ago, the professional predictors said people would never cook again. Instead, 30 years later, they were growing their own herbs and baking their own bread from scratch in well-to-do suburbs all over the First World. Similarly, it seemed unlikely that human beings would ever grow out of their need for personal contact. Live lectures and tutorials were not quite as large a part of the learning experience as they had once been, when books were the only form of stored information. But those who had claimed that such time and resource-wasteful human contact would vanish had obviously been wrong. One of Rini's pre-law friends from university had married a policeman. Before she and the friend lost touch, she had gone to dinner with them a few times, and she remembered the husband saying much the same thing about criminology. No matter how many gadgets were invented for discerning truth, analyzers of heartbeat, brainwaves, voice stress, or electrochemical changes to the skin, police always felt most secure when they could look a suspect in the eye and ask questions. So the need for real contact was universal, it seemed. However many changes had taken place in the human environment, most of them authored by humanity itself, the human brain was still much the same organ that everyone's ancestors had carried around the Olduvai Gorge 1,000,000 years ago. It imported information and tried to make sense of it. There was no discrimination between real and unreal, not at the most basic, instinctual levels of fear and desire and self-preservation. Weenie had begun pondering these things because of Stephen's friend Soki. She had reached his mother on the phone early that morning, but Patricia Mwete, whom Weenie had never known well, was adamant that Weenie should not come to the house. Soki had been sick, she said, and was just starting to get better. It would upset him. After a long and somewhat heated discussion, Patricia had finally agreed to let her talk to Soki on the phone when he got back from some undefined appointment that afternoon. At first, Rini's chain of thought had been prompted by the unsatisfactory nature of phone contact compared to an actual meeting. But now, as she considered the larger issues, she began to realize that if she continued to search for the cause of Stephen's illness, especially if it stemmed from his use of the net, she was going to be spending a great deal of time trying to separate unreality from reality. Certainly it was impossible at this point to even think of sharing her thoughts with the authorities, medical or legal. VR had received alarmist press from time to time, especially in the early days. All new technologies did. And there were certainly cases of post-traumatic stress syndrome in users of extremely violent simulations. But none of the accepted case histories looked anything like Stephen's. Also, despite her own not quite definable certainty that something had happened to him online, there was no real proof in the correlation of net usage to incidents of coma. 1,000 other factors could and would be suggested as equally likely to establish the pattern. But the even more frightening thing was the idea of trying to establish truth on the net itself. A police detective with the full weight of law and training on her side would have trouble working through the masks and illusions that net users constructed for themselves, not to mention their UN-mandated privacy rights. And me, she thought, if I'm right, and that's where it takes me, I'll be like Alice trying to solve a murder in Wonderland. A knock at her office door interrupted the gloomy thoughts. Habu poked his head in. Rini, are you busy? Come on in. I was going to mail you. I really appreciate you spending so much time with me yesterday. I feel very bad about taking you away from your home and your studies. Habu looked slightly embarrassed. I would like to be your friend. Friends help other friends. Also, I must confess to you, it is a strange and interesting situation. That may be, but you have your own life. Don't you usually spend your evenings studying in the library? He smiled. The school was closed. Of course. She made a face and pulled a cigarette from her coat. The bomb threat. It's a bad sign when they get so common that I don't even remember we had one until someone mentions it. And you know something? No one else did until you. Just another day in the big city. There was another knock. One of Rini's colleagues, the woman who taught the entry-level programming classes, had come to borrow a book. She talked the whole time she was in the office, telling some drawn-out story about an amazing restaurant her boyfriend had taken her to. She left without ever looking at or addressing a remark to Habu, as though he were a piece of furniture. Rini was chagrined by the woman's manners, but the small man appeared not to notice. "Have you thought any more about what you learned last night?" he asked when they had the office to themselves. "I am still not quite sure what you think could have happened to your brother. How could something unreal have such an effect, especially if his equipment was very basic? If something was harming him, what would prevent him from taking off the headset?" "He did take it off, or at least he didn't have it on when I found him, and I don't have an answer for you. I wish I did." The difficulty, perhaps even the ridiculous impossibility of finding the answers to Stephen's illness on the net, suddenly made her terribly weary. She ground out her cigarette and watched the last of the smoke twisting toward the ceiling. This could all be the hallucinations of a grieving relative. Sometimes people need reasons for things, even when there are no reasons. That's what makes people believe in conspiracies or religions. If there's any difference, the world is just too complicated, so they need simple explanations. Habu looked at her with what felt to Rini like mild disapproval.
But there are patterns to things. Both science and religion agree on that. So what is left is the honorable but difficult task of trying to decide which patterns are real and what they mean.
She stared at him for a moment, surprised again by his perceptiveness. You're right, of course, she said. So I suppose I might as well keep looking at this particular pattern and see if it means anything. Do you want to sit in while I call Stephen's other friend?
If it will not interfere.
Shouldn't. I'll tell her you're a friend from the Poly.
I hope I am a friend from the Poly.
You are. But I'm hoping she'll think you're another instructor. You'd better take off that tie. You look like something out of an old movie.
Habu looked a little disappointed. He was proud of what he saw as the formal correctness of his dress.
Rini hadn't found the heart to tell him that he was the only person under the age of 60 she had ever seen wearing a tie. But he complied, then pulled over a chair and sat beside her, his back very straight. Patricia Mwete opened the line. She regarded Habu with open suspicion, but was mollified by Rini's explanation.
"Don't ask Soki too many questions," she warned. "He's tired. He's been sick."
She was dressed rather formally herself. Rini vaguely remembered that she worked in some kind of financial institution, and guessed that she had just come back from work.
"I don't want to do anything that will upset him," Rini said. "But my brother is in a coma, Patricia, and no one knows why. I just want to find out anything I can."
The other woman's worried stiffness eased a little.
"I know, Irene. I'm sorry. I'll call him."
When Soki arrived, Rini was a little surprised to see how very well he looked. He hadn't lost any weight, he had always been a little on the husky side, and his smile was quick and strong.
"Hello, Rini."
"Hello, Soki. I'm sorry to hear you've been ill."
He shrugged. His mother, just off-screen, said something Rini couldn't hear.
"I'm okay. How's Stephen?"
Rini told him, and most of Soki's good humor evaporated. "I heard about it, but I thought maybe it was just for a little while. Like that kid in our farm who got a concussion. Is he going to die?" She recoiled a little at the bluntness of the question. A moment passed before she could answer.
"I don't think so. But I'm very worried about him. We don't know what's wrong." That's why I wanted to ask you some questions. Can you tell me anything about the things that you and Stephen and Eddie were doing on the net?
Soki looked at her a little strangely, surprised by the question, then launched into a long description of various legitimate and quasi-legitimate netboy meanderings, punctuated every now and then by sounds of disapproval from his temporarily invisible mother.
But what I really want to know about Soki is the last time, just before you got sick, when you three got into Inner District.
He looked at her blankly. Inner District?
You know what that is.
Certain, but we never got in there. I told you we tried.
Are you saying you never went into the Inner District?
The look on his young face hardened into anger.
Did Eddie say we did? And he's Duppy. Duppy Major.
Reenie paused, taken aback. Soki, I had to go in and get Eddie and Stephen out. They said you were with them. They were worried about you because they lost you on the net.
Soki's voice rose.
They're dupping!
Reenie was confused. Was he putting this on just because his mother was around?
If so, he was doing a very convincing job. He seemed genuinely indignant.
Or had Eddie and Stephen lied to her about Soki being with them? But why? His mother leaned into the screen. You're getting him upset, Irene. Why are you calling my boy a liar? She took a deep breath. I'm not, Patricia. I'm just confused. If he wasn't with them, why would they lie about it? It didn't get them off the hook. Stephen still lost his net privileges.
She shook her head.
I don't know what's going on, Soki. Are you sure you don't remember any of this? About getting into Inner District? About going to a place called Mr. J's? About falling through some kind of door? Blue lights?
I've never been there!
He was angry. Angry and scared. But he still didn't seem to be lying. A few drops of perspiration had appeared on his forehead.
Doors, blue lights, I never...
That's enough, Irene, said Patricia. Enough!
Before Reenie could reply, Soki suddenly tipped his head back and made a strange gargling noise. His limbs became rigid, and his entire body began to tremble violently. His mother grabbed at his shirt, but failed to hold him as he slid off the chair and fell to the floor, thrashing, staring at the screen, helplessly transfixed. Reenie heard Habu gasp beside her.
God damn you, Irene Sulawayo! Patricia shouted. He was getting better. You did this to him. Don't you ever call this house again!
She knelt beside her son and cradled his twitching head. A froth of spittle had already begun to form on his lips.
Disconnect! She shouted,
and the pad screen went dark. The last thing Reenie saw were the white crescents of Soki's eyes. His pupils had rolled up beneath the lids. She tried to phone back immediately, despite Patricia's angry words, but the line at Soki's aunt's house was accepting no incoming calls.
That was a seizure.
Her fingers trembled as she pulled the flame tab on a cigarette.
That was a grand mal seizure. But he's not epileptic, damn it. Habu, I've known that child for years, and I had to play chaperone on enough field trips for Stephen's schools. They always tell you if one of the kids has major health problems.
She was furious, although she didn't know why. She was also frightened. But the reasons for that were clear enough.
Something happened to him that day, the day I went to get them out of the Inner District. Then later it happened to Stephen, but worse. God, I wish Patricia would answer my questions.
Habu's yellow-brown skin was a shade paler than usual. We spoke before of the medicine trance, he said. I felt I was witnessing such a thing. He had the look of someone meeting the gods.
That was no trance, damn it. And there weren't any gods involved. That was a full-blown seizure.
Reenie was ordinarily careful not to tread on the beliefs of others. But just now she had very little patience for her friend's sorcerous notions. Habu, apparently not offended, watched her as she stood and began pacing, rattling with anger and upset.
Something has interfered with that child's brain, a physical effect in the real world from something that happened online.
She went to the office door and pushed it shut. Soki's collapse had intensified her feelings of being shadowed by some nameless danger. A more cautious part of her protested that she was leaping ahead much too fast, making far more assumptions than could be scientifically safe. But she wasn't listening to that part of herself at the moment. She turned back to Habu.
I'm going there. I have to.
Where?
To the Inner District? To that club, Mr. J's. Something happened to Soki there. I'm almost certain that Stephen tried to sneak back in while he was staying at Eddie's.
If there is something bad there, something dangerous... Habu shook his head. What would be the point?
What would the people who own this virtual club have to gain?
It may be a byproduct of one of their unpleasant little amusements. Eddie said they're supposed to have experiences for sale that transcend whatever equipment the users own. Maybe they've found some way to give the illusion of greater sensory receptiveness. They might be using compacted subliminals, ultrasonics, something illegal that has these terrible side effects.
She sat down and began excavating the mess of papers on her desk in search of an ashtray.
Whatever it is, if I'm going to find out, I'll have to do it myself. It would take forever to get anyone to investigate. UNCOM is the world's worst bureaucracy.
She found the ashtray, but her hands were shaking so hard that she almost dropped it.
But will you not be exposing yourself to danger? What if you are affected as your brother was?
The little man's usually smooth forehead was wrinkled in a deep frown of worry.
I'll be a lot more alert than Stephen was, and a lot better informed. Also, I'll just be looking for possible causes, enough to build a case to take to the authorities.
She crushed out the cigarette.
And maybe if I figure out what happened, we'll be able to find some way to reverse the damage.
She curled her hands into fists.
I want my brother back.
You are determined to go.
She nodded, reaching for her pad.
She was filled with a high and even slightly giddy sense of clarity. There were many things to do. She had to construct an alias, for one thing. If the people who owned the club had something to hide, she would be foolish to walk in under her own name and index. And she wanted to do some more research into the club itself and the company that owned it. Anything she could learn before going in might improve her chances of recognizing useful evidence once she was on the inside.
Then you should not go unaccompanied,
Khabu said quietly.
But I... Hold on. Are you talking about you coming with me?
You need a companion. What if something were to happen to you? Who would take your story to the proper authorities?
I'll leave notes. A letter.
No, Khabu, you can't. Her engine was running now. She was ready to move, and this seemed a distraction. She didn't want to take the small man. Her entry would have to be illegal, for one thing. If she were caught, her crime would be seen as much worse if she had dragged a student along with her.
Exams begin in 2 days.
Khabu almost seemed to have sensed her thoughts.
After that, I will no longer be your student.
It's illegal.
There would be a presumption that, newcomer to the big city that I am, stranger to modern ways, I did not understand I was doing wrong. If necessary, I would help to support that presumption.
But you must have your own responsibilities.
Khabu smiled sadly.
Some day, Rini, I will tell you of my responsibilities. But at the moment, I certainly have a responsibility to a friend, and that is very important. Please, I ask you this as a favor. Wait until exams are finished. That will give you time to prepare in any case. I am sure there are more questions to be asked before you confront these people directly. More answers to be sought.
Rini hesitated. He was right. At least a few days of preparation would have to be fitted in around her work schedule anyway. But would he be an asset or a liability? Khabu returned her gaze with nonchalance. For all his youth and small stature, there was something almost daunting about the bushman. His calm and confidence were very persuasive.
Okay,
she said at last. Being patient took a tremendous effort of will.
If Stephen doesn't get any worse, I'll wait. But if you come with me, you do what I say while we're in there. Understand that? You're very talented for a beginner. But you are a beginner.
Khabu's smile widened.
Yes, teacher. I promise.
Then get out of my office and go study for those exams. I have work to do.
He bowed slightly and went out, the door closing silently behind him. The displaced air stirred the remnants of her cigarette smoke. Rini watched them eddy across the light from the window, a swirl of meaningless, ever-changing patterns. That night, the dream came again. Khabu stood at the edge of a great precipice, examining a pocket watch. This time it had sprouted legs and was walking on his palm like a flat silver beetle. Something hovered in the air beyond the edge of the cliff, obscured by the mist but moving closer. It was a bird, she thought, when she first saw the wings. No, it was an angel, a shimmering, smoke-blue presence with a human face. The face was Stephen's. As he drifted nearer, he called to her, but his voice was lost in the rush of the wind. She cried out, startling Khabu, who turned and took a step backward, then tumbled over the edge and vanished. Stephen looked down at where the little man had fallen, then lifted his tearful gaze to Rini. His mouth moved again, but she still could not hear him. A wind seemed to catch him.
spreading his wings and making his whole being ripple. Before Rini could move, he was swept away into the mist. Chapter 8. Dread. Netfeed. News. Police kill 22 cannibal cultists. Visual. Body bags being laid out in front of building. V.O.
Greek military police gunned down 22 members of the controversial Anthropophagi cult, reputed to engage in ritual cannibalism in a firefight that turned the center of Naxos into a war zone. One policeman was killed and two others injured in the fierce exchange.
Visual. Bearded man holding up bone, shouting at audience.
Pending identification of the bodies, some badly burned, it is not known whether the group's leader, Dimitrios Chrysostomos, shown here in footage recorded covertly by a government informant, was one of those killed in the assault on the Sacristos.
He liked the way he was moving. A slow lope, like a leopard just before it sprang. He upped the volume and the shuddering drums were everywhere. He felt good. The soundtrack running on his internal system made it all perfect. Camera. Camera, he thought, tracking the woman with his eyes.
She had a rump, that one. It made him smile just to see its purposeful movements.
And to accent the smile, he called in a trumpet glissando, sharp and cold as a knife. The silvery tones made him think about his own blade, a flat-backed Zeising tendon cutter. So he pulled it out for a close-up look as the trumpet wailed, a slow dissolve that brought him up hard as a rock all over. The woman jounced down the steps to the underground parking lot, hurrying a little. That fine rump bobbed, drawing his eyes away from the knife. Pale woman, rich and gym slender, hair the color of sand, all trussed up in those fancy white pants. She hadn't seen him yet, but she must know he was following. Some animal part of her that, gazelle-like, could smell the danger. She looked back when she hit the bottom of the stairs, and for a brief instant her eyes widened. She knew. As he stepped down into the shadowy stairwell, he accelerated the drums. They bounced around inside his head, battering his skull like boxing gloves against the heavy bag. But his stride did not increase. He was too much of an artist for that.
Better to go slow. Slow. He turned down the volume of the skittering drums to enjoy the inevitability of the unfolding climax.
End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.
Side 5. City of Golden Shadow. Other Land, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 132.
A sneaky counter-rhythm crept into the mix. An off-balance wallop like a failing heart. She was nearing her car now, fumbling for the remote. He tuned his vision until the woman and her heat were the only thing that glimmered in the dark garage. He sped up, prodding the music along so that more horns came in and the beats overlapped, building toward a crescendo. His fingers descended lightly, but the shock of his touch still made her shriek and drop her bag. Its contents spilled across the cement floor. Sought for remote. Expensive Singapore datapad. Tubes of lip gloss like bullet cartridges. The tumbled bag retained a heat trace of her hand, already fading. Aggression fought with fear across her face. Anger that someone like him should touch her, should make her spill her oh-so-private life on the floor. But as he moved to close up on her face, his own mouth twisting in a grin, fear won out.
"What do you want?"
The voice hitched, barely audible above the clamor rattling through the bones of his skull.
"You can have my card. Here, take it."
He smiled, lazy, and the crescendo flattened out and held. The knife flicked up, pausing for a moment against her cheek.
"What does Dread want? Your stuff, sweetness. Your sweet stuff."
Later, when he had finished, he slid the music down to a sunset diminuendo, chirping sounds like crickets, a mournful violin. He stepped over the spreading wetness and picked up her bank card, grimacing. What fool would take something like that? Only an outback idiot would fix the mark of Cain to his own forehead. He lifted the blade and traced the word Sang across the card's hologrammed surface in lines of red, then dropped it beside her.
"Who needs VR when you got RL?
he whispered.
"Real, real."
The god looked down from his high throne in the heart of Abydos that was.
across the bent backs of his thousand priests, prostrated before him like so many turtles sunning on the Nile's bank, past the smokes of 100,000 censers and the glimmering light of 100,000 lamps. His gaze passed even into the shadows at the farthest reaches of his vast throne room, and on through the labyrinth of passages that separated throne room from city of the dead. But still he could not locate the one he sought. Impatient, the god tapped his flail on the gilded arm of his chair. High priest something or other. The god could not be bothered with the names of all his underlings. They came and went like grains of sand in a windstorm, crawled to the dais on which the golden chair rested, and rubbed his face against the granite tiles. Oh, beloved of Shining Ra, father of Horus, lord of the two lands, the priest intoned, who is master of all the people, who makes the wheat to grow, who died but lives. O great Lord Osiris, hear your humble servant. The god sighed. Speak. O beautiful Shining One, O Lord of green things, this humble one wishes to tell you of a certain unrest. Unrest? The god leaned forward, bringing his dead face so close to the prostrate priest that the old worthy almost wet himself. In my kingdom? The priest sputtered. It is your two servants, Tefi and Mewat, who trouble your worshippers with their evil behavior. Surely it is not your wish that they should make drunken riot in the priest's sanctuaries and terrify the poor dancers in such a distressing way. And it is told that they perform even darker acts in their private chambers. The old priest cringed. I speak to you only of what others already say, O King of the Uttermost West, beloved and undying Osiris. The god sat back, his mask concealing amusement. He wondered how long it had taken this non-entity to work up the courage to broach the subject. He briefly contemplated feeding him to the crocodiles, but could not remember if this high priest was a citizen or merely a puppet. Either way, it seemed too much trouble. I shall consider this, he said, and raised the crook and the flail. Osiris loves his servants, the greatest and the smallest. Blessed is he, our lord of life and death, the priest gabbled, crawling backward. He made excellent time, considering the indignity of his posture. If he was a citizen, he had mastered his simulation skills well. The god decided it was good he had not fed this one to the crocodiles. He might prove useful some day. As for the god's wicked servants, well, that was their job description, was it not? Of course, it was preferable that the pair be wicked somewhere other than in his favorite and most intricately constructed sanctuary. Let them make their holidays in old Chicago or Xanadu. Then again, perhaps more than mere banishment was in order. A little discipline might not go amiss where the fat one and the thin one were concerned. He looked up from these thoughts at the brazen cry of a trumpet and the tattoo of a shallow drum from the rear of the throne room. Yellow-green eyes glowed in the shadows there. At last, he said, and crossed his emblems on his chest once more. The thing that stepped out of the darkness, and before which the priests parted like the great river swirling around an island, appeared to be almost 8 feet tall. Its handsome brown body was muscular, long-limbed, and vital. But from the neck up, it was a beast. The jackal head swiveled, watching the priests scurry aside. The lips curled back, showing long white teeth. I have been waiting for you, messenger of death, said the god. Waiting too long. Anubis dropped to one knee, a cursory gesture, then rose. I had things to do. The god took a calming breath. He needed this creature and its particular talents. It was important to remember that. Things? Yes, just a few matters. The long red tongue emerged and swept over the muzzle. In the candlelight, traces of what looked like flecks of blood showed dark against the long fangs. The god grimaced in distaste. Your heedless pursuits. You risk yourself needlessly. That is not pleasing. I do what I do, like always. The wide shoulders shrugged. The bright eyes closed in a lazy blink. But you have summoned me, and I have come. What do you want, grandfather? Do not call me that. It is impertinent as well as inaccurate. The old god took another deep breath. It was hard not to react to the messenger, whose every movement reeked with the insolence of destruction. I have discovered something of great importance. I seem to have an adversary. The teeth flashed again, briefly.
You wish me to kill him.
The god's delighted laughter was entirely genuine. Young fool! If I knew who he was and could set you upon him, then he would not be worthy to be called my adversary. He or she. He chuckled. The jackal head tipped to one side, like that of a scolded dog.
Then what do you want of me?
Nothing. Yet. But soon there will be dark alleys aplenty for you to haunt, and many bones for you to crack in those great jaws.
You seem happy, grandfather.
The god twitched, but let it pass. Yes, I am happy. It has been so long since I have been tested, since any but the most feeble have opposed me. The mere fact that one has risen against me and has trifled in even the smallest of my plans is a delight. My greatest test of all is coming, and if there were no opposition, there would be no art.
But you have no idea who it is. Perhaps it is someone inside the Brotherhood.
I have thought of it. It is possible. Not likely, but possible. The green-gold eyes flared.
I could find out for you.
The thought of unleashing this rough beast in that particular chicken coop was diverting but unworkable. I think not. You are not my only servant, and I have subtler means of gathering information. The jackal's tone became petulant.
So you called me away from other things, merely to tell me that you have no tasks for me?
The god swelled until his mummy wrappings creaked and snapped, growing until his death mask face loomed far above the throne room floor. The thousand priests groaned, like sleepers beset with the same bad dream. The jackal took a step backward.
I call, and you come!
The voice boomed and echoed beneath the painted ceiling.
Do not think that you are indispensable, messenger!
Howling and clutching at his head, the jackal god fell to his knees. The moaning of the priests intensified. After what he deemed a suitable interlude, Osiris lifted his hand, and the cry of pain died away. Anubis collapsed stomach first to the floor, panting. Long moments passed before he dragged himself up onto his hands and knees. His trembling head bowed until the pointed ears brushed the steps before the throne. The god resumed his normal size and surveyed Anubis bent back with satisfaction. But as it happens, I do have a task for you, and it does, in fact, concern one of my colleagues. But it is a work of a less delicate nature than unmasking a secret adversary. My words of command are being sent to you even now.
I am grateful, O Lord.
His voice was hoarse and hard to understand. The candles flared in the heart of Abydus that was. The messenger of death received another commission. Dread yanked the fiber link from its slot and rolled off the bed onto the floor. Eyes clamped shut with pain, he crawled to the bathroom and groped for the rim of the tub, then vomited up the vat-grown kebab that had been his lunch. His stomach went on convulsing long after he had emptied himself. When it stopped, he slumped against the wall, gasping. The old man had never been able to do that before. A painful buzzing here, a nasty splash of vertigo there, but never anything like that. It felt like a knitting needle had been pushed in one of his ears and pulled out the other. He spat bile into a towel, then dragged himself erect and stumbled to the sink to wash the digestive fluids from his lips and chin. It had been a long time since anyone had made him hurt like that. It was something to think about. Part of him, the squinting child who had first confronted the authorities after hitting another 6-year-old in the face with a hammer, wanted to find out the old bastard's true name, track him to his R.L. hideaway, then razor him and pull his skin off string by string. But another part, the adult creature who had grown from that child, had learned subtlety. Both parts, however, admired the exercise of naked power. When he was on top someday, he would act no differently. Weak dogs became bones for other, stronger dogs. Helpless rage was a hindrance, he reminded himself. Whoever the old man really was, going after him would be like trying to storm hell to throw rocks at the devil. He was a big wheel in the Brotherhood, maybe the biggest, for all Dredd knew. He probably lived surrounded by overarmed bodyguards in one of those hardened underground silos so popular with the filthy rich, or on some fortified island like a villain in a Malaysian slash-and-smash Netflix. Tasting his own acids, Dredd spat again. He must be patient. For the moment, anger was useless except as carefully controlled fuel. It was far easier and smarter just to keep doing what the old man wanted, for the moment. There would be a day later on when the jackal would rise to its master's throat. Patience, patience. He lifted his head into the frame of the mirror and stared at his reflection. He needed to see himself clean again, hard, untouched. No one had made him feel this way for a long time, and the ones who had were all dead now. Only the first few had died quickly. Patience. No mistakes. He steadied his breathing and straightened up, stretching the kinks from aching stomach muscles. He leaned forward, zooming into close-up, the hero looking back with dark, flat eyes, swallowing his pain. Unstoppable. Music up. Coming back strong. He stared at the puke-stained tub for a moment, then turned on the water, washing the vomit away in a swirl of brown. Edit that. Edit the whole tub scene. Missed the point. Unstoppable. At least this new job would be R.L. He was tired of the costumed silliness of these rich fools, living out fantasies that would shame the lowest chargehead just because they could afford to. This task would have real risks, and it would end in real blood. That was worthy of him, at least, and of his special skills. The target, though, he frowned. Despite what he'd said to the old man, he wasn't crazy about being in the middle of one of these Brotherhood feuds. Too unpredictable. Like some net thing he'd seen back in school. Kings and queens, scheming, poisoning. Still, such things had a hidden benefit. Let them all kill each other. It would just hasten the day when he could make things happen. He rinsed his mouth again, then walked back to his bed. He needed his music. No wonder he felt off balance. The soundtrack put everything into perspective, kept the story moving. He hesitated, remembering the agony the implants had so recently brought him, but only for a moment. He was Dredd, and his chosen name was also his chosen game. His. No old man was going to frighten him. He summoned up the music. It came without pain, a firm syncopation, quiet conga drums and dragging bass. He laid a series of sustained organ chords over them, ominous but cool. Thinking music, planning music, you'll never catch me music. Even now that downtown parking garage must be full of police detectives, dusting, scanning, taking infrareds, wondering why the crime didn't show up on their closed-circuit camera drones, all standing around examining the rags of white and red. Poor pussy. And she hadn't wanted anyone touching her stuff. Another one dead, they'd be saying. All over the net soon. He'd have to remember to watch some of the coverage. Dredd leaned back against the bare white wall as the music pulsed through him. Time to do some work. He summoned the information the old bastard had sent him. Then called up some visuals, maps first, then Leos scans and 3D blues of the target location. They floated in the air before him like heavenly visions against the background of the other white wall. All his walls were white. Who needed pictures when you could make your own? Chapter 9. Mad Shadows. Netfeed Entertainment. Concrete Sun, highest rated for May. Visual, several explosions. Man in white coat running. V.O. The series-ending episode of Concrete Sun was the most watched net entertainment for the month of May. Visual. Man in white coat kissing one-legged woman. Appearing in 16% of homes worldwide. Visual. Man in white coat carrying a bandaged dog through culvert. The story of a fugitive doctor hiding out in the squatter city of Bridge End Tunnel is the highest-rated linear drama in 4 years. Rini turned her head sharply, and the test pattern, an unending domino row of grids in contrasting colors, jiggled. She grimaced. A touch against one of the dimples on the side of her headset brought up the pressure in the padding. She waggled her head. Now the image stayed put. She lifted her hands, then curled her right index finger. The front grid, a simple lattice of glowing yellow, remained where it was. All the other grids moved a little farther apart from each other, rippling out into the indeterminate distance. One full lockstep into infinity. She bent the finger farther, and the distance between each grid shrank. She wagged her finger to the right, and the entire array rotated, each a fraction of an instant behind the one before it, so that a neon spiral formed and then vanished as the grids came to rest once more. "Now you do it," she told Khabu. He carefully wove his hands through a complex series of movements, each of which marked different points of distance and attitude from the sensor affixed to the front of his visor like a third eye. The unending sequence of colored grids responded, spinning, shrinking, changing relationships like an exploding universe of square stars. Rini nodded in approval, even though Khabu could not see her. The test pattern and the all-surrounding blackness were the only visuals.
"Good," she said. "Let's try out your memory. Take as many of those grids as you want, not from the front, and make a polyhedron."
Khabu carefully withdrew his selections from the array. As the rest moved to fill the vacated space, he stretched those he had chosen and folded them in half along the diagonal, then rapidly assembled the paired triangles into a faceted ball.
"You are getting good."
She was pleased. Not that she could take too much credit. She had never taught anyone who worked as hard as Khabu, and he had a tremendous natural aptitude. Very few people could adapt themselves to the unnatural rules of Netspace as quickly and completely as he had.
"Then may I put this away now, Rini?" he asked. "Please? We have been preparing all morning."
She flicked her hand, and the test pattern disappeared. A moment later they stood facing each other in a 360-degree ocean of gray, sim to unprepossessing sim. She bit back a nettled reply. He was right. She had been delaying, going over and over her preparations as though this were some kind of combat mission instead of a simple trip into the inner district in search of information. Not that, strictly speaking, there was such a thing as a simple trip into inner district for outsiders like them. There might very well be barriers they could not pass, no matter how well prepared they were. But she did not want to be unmasked and ejected because of some stupid, preventable mistake. Also, if there was something illegal and dangerous going on in Toy Town, discovery of her investigation would put the guilty ones on guard, and perhaps even lead them to destroy evidence that otherwise might save Stephen.
"I did not intend to be rude, Rini."
Khabu Sim lifted its simple hands in a gesture of peace. A rather mechanical-looking smile curled the corners of its mouth.
"But I think that you too will be happier when we are doing something."
"You're probably right. Disconnect and exit."
Everything vanished. She lifted the visor on her headset, and the earnest but seedy ambience of the Polly's harness room surrounded her once more. The bushman pushed up his own visor and blinked, grinning. Reflexively, she began one final run through her mental checklist. While Khabu had finished his exams, which the grapevine told her he had handled with expected ease, she had created not just aliases to get them into the inner district, but several backups as well. If things went badly, they could shuck off their first identities like old skin. But it had not been easy. Creating a false online identity was no different than creating one for RL, and was in many ways the same process. Rini had spent a good portion of her time in the last few days hunting through backwater areas of the net. There were lots of vaguely unsavory people lurking in Lambda Mall's equivalent of dark alleyways for whom setting up false identities was everyday work. But ultimately, she had decided to do it herself. If her investigations of the inner district struck something important, the offended parties would go looking for the bootleg identity merchants first. Not a one of them would take a stand for privileged information when their livelihood, and perhaps even health, was at stake. So, pumped up on caffeine and sugar, smoking an endless chain of theoretically non-carcinogenic cigarettes, she had set off to do a little akisu, as the old-timers called it. She had worked her way through hundreds of obscure infobanks, copying bits and pieces as it suited her, inserting false cross-check data on the systems whose defenses were outdated or weak enough. She had created a reasonably solid false identity for both of them, and, she hoped, even some insurance if things went very wrong. She had also learned a few things about Mr. Jays along the way, which was one of the reasons she had been drilling Khabu all morning. The Inner District Club had a very dark reputation, and interfering with its operation might have some unpleasant real-world repercussions. Despite her initial impatience, she was glad Khabu had talked her into waiting for him. In fact, even another week to prepare wouldn't have gone amiss. She took a breath. Enough. If she weren't careful, she would turn into one of those obsessive compulsives who turned back 5 times to make sure the door was locked.
Okay, she said. Let's get going.
They made a few final tests of their harnesses, both of which hung from the ceiling by an arrangement of straps and pulleys that would allow their users freedom of movement in VR, as well as prevent them from walking into real walls or hurting themselves with a fall. When the pulleys had hauled them aloft, they dangled side by side in the middle of the padded room like a pair of marionettes on the puppeteer's day off.
Do what I say without questions. We can't afford to make mistakes. My brother's life could be at stake. I'll give you answers afterward.
Weenie checked one last time to make sure none of the wires would be worked loose by the action of the harness straps, then pulled her visor back down. The visuals flicked on, and the gray sparkle of the waiting net surrounded her.
And remember, even though the closed band is provided by the Inner District, not the club itself, once we get inside you'd better assume that someone is listening.
I understand, Weenie. He sounded cheerful, which was amazing considering that she had already given him the eavesdropper's speech 2 times that morning. She waved her hands, and they went. The crowd waiting at the Inner District gateway was a brightly colored, noisy blur. As the clamor of their multilingual pleading thundered painfully in her ears, she realized that in her anxiety not to miss any possible clues, she had set the gain on her sensory inputs 2 high. A flick of the wrist and a circled finger brought them down to a manageable level. After a wait that had Rini bouncing in place with impatience, they at last slid to the front of the line. The female functionary was polite, and seemed remarkably uninterested in making trouble. She examined their false identification, then asked if the reason for their visit, submitted as part of the ID package, was still correct.
It is. I'm examining an installation we've had a complaint about.
Weenie's alias showed her working for a large Nigerian programming company with Khabu as her trainee, a gear company which, she had discovered, kept very sloppy records.
And how much time will you need, Mr. Otepi?
Weenie was astonished. Actual kindness. She was not used to tractability from net bureaucrats. She eyed the smiling sim carefully, wondering if she were dealing with some new kind of hyper-actualized customer service puppet.
It's hard to say. If the problem is simple enough, I may fix it myself. But first I must run it through its paces to find out.
8 hours?
8. She knew people who would pay several thousand credits for that long a period of access to the Inner District. In fact, if she had any time left over when they finished, she was tempted to go find one of them. She wondered if she should try to get more. Maybe this puppet was broken, a slot machine that would just pay and pay, but decided not to press her luck.
That should be adequate.
A moment later they were through, floating just above ground level in Monumental Gateway Plaza.
You don't realize it, she told Khabu on their private band. But you've just witnessed a miracle.
What is that?
A bureaucratic system that actually does what it's supposed to do.
He turned to her, a half-smile illuminating the face of the sim Rini had arranged for the visit.
Which is to let in 2 disguised people who are pretending to have legitimate business?
Nobody likes a comedian,
she pointed out, then exited from the private band.
We're clear. We can go anywhere we want to now,
except private notes.
Khabu surveyed the plaza.
The crowds seem different here than in the Lambda Mall, and the structures are more extreme.
That's because you're closer to the center of power. People here do what they want because they can afford to.
A thought came swirling up like a flake of hot black ash.
People who can get away with anything, or think they can.
Stephen was comatose in the hospital, while the men who had hurt him enjoyed their freedom. Her anger, never completely cold, rekindled.
Let's go have a look around Toy Town.
Lullaby Lane was far more crowded than the last time she had been there, almost choked with virtual bodies. Caught by surprise, Weenie pulled Khabu into an alley so she could figure out what was happening. The crowd flowed past the alley mouth in one direction, shouting and singing. It seemed to be a parade of sorts. The Sims were embodied in a variety of bizarre ways. Oversized, undersized, extra-limbed, even divided into unconnected body parts that moved like coherent wholes. Some of the revelers shifted and changed even as she watched. One violet-haired, attenuated figure wore enormous bat wings, which dissolved into traceries of fluttering silver gauze. Many reformed themselves every few moments, extruding new limbs, changing heads, spreading and curling into fantastic shapes like boiling wax dumped in cold water.
"Welcome to Toy Town," she thought. "Looks like we arrived just in time for a reunion of the Hieronymus Bosch Society."
She took the Bushmen up to rooftop level, where they could get a better view. Several in the crowd bore glowing banners proclaiming freedom, or spelled it out above their heads in fire. One group had even turned themselves into a walking row of letters that spelled out Mutation Day. Although most of the parader Sims were extreme by design, they were also rather unstable. Some of them fell apart into unstructured planes and lines in a way that did not look intentional. Others flickered in mid-step and occasionally disappeared entirely.
"Home-cooked programming," she decided. "Do-it-yourself stuff."
"It's a protest, I think," she told Khabu. "Against what person or thing?"
He hung in the air beside her, a cartoon figure with a serious expression on its simple face.
"Embodiment laws, I would guess. But they can't be suffering much if they can afford to hang out here in the first place."
She made a small noise of contempt.
"Rich people's children complaining because their parents won't let them dress up. Let's go."
They beamed past the procession to the far end of Lullaby Lane, where the streets were empty. Without the distraction of street theater, the run-down quality of the neighborhood was immediately apparent. Many of the nodes seemed to have grown even more decrepit since her last visit. Both sides of the street were lined with skeletal, colorless buildings. A distant, skittery flare of music at last turned them toward a garish glow at the street's far end. In such dim surroundings, the awful, throbbing liveliness of Mr. J's seemed even more sinister. Khabu stared at the turreted sprawl and the giant carnivorous grin.
"So that is it.
Private band," Rini snapped. "And keep it there unless you have to answer a question from someone. As soon as you finish answering, switch back. Don't worry about being slow to respond. I'm sure they get lots of people in that place whose reflexes are not what they should be."
They slowly floated forward, watching the club's facade gleam and squirm.
"Why are there no people about?" asked Khabu.
"Because this isn't a part of the inner district that invites much sightseeing. People who come to Mr. J's probably beam in directly. Are you ready?"
"I believe so. Are you?"
Rini hesitated. The question seemed flippant, but that was not the Bushman's way. She realized she was wound tight and hard, her nerves thrumming. She took several deep breaths, willing herself toward calm. The toothy mouth over the doorway flapped its red lips as though whispering a promise. Mr. Jingo's Smile, this place had been called. Why did they change the name but keep that horrid grimace?
"It is a bad place," Khabu said abruptly.
"I know. Don't forget that for a second."
She splayed her fingers. An instant later they were in a shadowy antechamber, a place with gold-framed carnival mirrors instead of walls. As she turned to survey the room, Rini could see that the latency, the tiny lag between initiation and action that characterized complex VR environments, was very low here, a quite passable mimicry of real life. The detail work was also impressive. Alone in the antechamber, they were not alone in the mirrors. A thousand reveling ghosts surrounded them, figures of men and women, as well as some more animal than human, all cavorting around the distorted reflections of their two Sims. Their reflections appeared to be enjoying themselves.
"Welcome to Mr. J's."
The voice spoke oddly accented English. There was no image to match it in any of the mirrors. Rini turned to discover a tall, smiling, elegantly dressed white man standing close behind them. He lifted his gloved hands, and the mirrors disappeared, leaving the three of them alone in a single pillar of light, surrounded by infinite black.
"So nice to have you with us."
His voice crept in close, as though he whispered in her ear.
"Where are you from?"
Lagos, said Rini a little breathlessly. She hoped her own voice, processed an octave lower to match her masculine alias, did not sound as squeaky to him as it did to her. We've heard a lot about this place. The man's smile widened. He made a short bow.
We are proud of our worldwide reputation, and pleased to welcome friends from Africa. You are, of course, of legal age?
Of course. Even as she spoke, she knew that digital fingers were prying at the edge of her alias. But not prying too hard. Deniability was all that a place like this needed. I am showing my friend here some inter-district sites. He's never been before.
Splendid. You have brought him to the right place.
The well-dressed man was finished distracting them, which meant their indexes had been passed. He made a theatrical flourish, and a door opened in the darkness, a rectangular hole that bled smoky red light. Noise spilled out, too. Loud music, laughter, a wave crash of voices.
"Enjoy your visit," he said. "Tell your friends."
Then he was gone, and they were flowing forward into the scarlet glow. The music reached out to gather them in like the pseudopod of some immense but invisible energy creature. Blaringly loud, it sounded like the bouncy swing jazz of the previous century, but it had strange hiccups and slurs, secret rhythms moving deep inside like the heartbeat of a stalking predator. It was captivating. Rini found herself humming along before she could even make out words, but those came quickly enough. "There's no call for consternation," someone was singing urgently as the orchestra wailed and stomped in the background. "A smiling face is invitation enough. No bluff, so bring your stuff to the celebration." The lounge was impossibly huge, a monstrous red-lit octagon. The pillars that marked its angles, each one broad as a skyscraper, stretched up to disappear in shadow far above. The vertical rows of lights that trimmed them grew closer together, and at last shrank into continuous lines of radiance as distance squeezed them. Up where even those lights failed, up in the unspeakable heights of the ceiling, sparking fireworks zigged and caromed endlessly against the blackness. Spotlights wheeled through the smoky air, pushing fast-moving ellipses of brighter red across the velvet walls. Hundreds of booths sprawled between the pillars and filled the ringing balconies, which circled up at least a dozen floors before the swirling clouds of smoke made counting impossible. An almost endless mushroom forest of tables covered the shiny main floor, with silver-clad figures speeding between them like pinballs off bumpers. 1,000 waiters and waitresses, 2,000, more, all moving swiftly and frictionlessly as beads of mercury. In the center of the enormous room, the orchestra stood on a floating stage that sparkled and revolved like a sideways Ferris wheel. The musicians wore black-and-white formal suits, but there was nothing formal about them. They were cartoonishly attenuated and two-dimensional. As the music squalled, their shapes wavered and flared like mad shadows. Some grew until their rolling eyes peered directly into the highest balconies. Bright tombstone teeth snapped at the customers, who shrieked and laughed even as they scrambled for safer ground. Only the singer, perched at the farthest edge of the circling stage in a filmy white dress, did not change size. As the shadowy musicians billowed around her, she glowed like a piece of radium. "So toss away your trepidation," she sang, her voice harsh yet somehow alluring, its quaver that of a child forced to stay up too late, watching the adults grow strange and drunken. "Slip into some syncopation. No fuss. The bus will propel us to Party Station." The singer was only a spot of light in the midst of the Cyclopean lounge and the crazily stretching orchestra, but for long moments Rini found that she could not see anything else. Huge black eyes in a pale face made the woman look almost skeletal. Her fountain of white hair, half as tall as she was, combined with the white dress rippling beneath her arms to make her seem some kind of exotic bird. "Sit right down. Lose that frown. Mingle with the toast of Toy Town. Pick a song. Sing along. All that's upright will turn out wrong." The singer swayed back and forth, buffeted by the pounding beat like a dove in gale winds. The great eyes were closed now in something that might be exultation, but didn't seem like it. Reenie had never seen a human being look quite so trapped, and yet the singer glowed, burned. She might have been a light bulb channeling too much juice, her filament an instant away from explosive collapse. Slowly, almost unwillingly, Reenie reached out for Habu. She found his hand and closed her fingers on it. "Are you okay?"
It is quite overwhelming, this place."
"It is. Let's sit down for a moment."
She led him across the floor to one of the booths along the far wall, an RL journey that would have taken some minutes on foot, but which they made in seconds. All the musicians in the orchestra were singing now, clapping and hooting and stamping their mighty feet on the rocking stage. The music was so loud that it seemed the whole gigantic house might fall down.
"Free your heart of hesitation. Eves and Adams of every nation-state feel great when they create a federation."
The music swelled, and the spotlights raced even faster, beams flickering across each other like fencers' foils. There was a cannon-fire rattle of drums, a last explosive blare of horns. Then the orchestra was gone. A hollow chorus of hoots and cheers wafted through the immense room. Reenie and Habu had barely sunk into the deep velvet banquette when a waiter appeared before them, floating a few inches off the floor. He wore a chrome-colored, form-fitted tuxedo. His sim body appeared to have been modeled after some ancient fertility deity.
"Zazoon, creepers," he drawled. "What'll it be?"
We can't eat or drink in these sims," Reenie said. "Do you have anything else?"
He gave her an intensely knowing and slightly amused look, clicked his fingers, and vanished. A menu of glowing letters hung in the air behind him like a luminescent residue.
"There's a list labeled emotions," Habu said wonderingly.
"Sorrow, mild to intense. Happiness, tranquil contentment to violent joy. Fulfillment, misery. Optimism, despair. Pleasant surprise. Madness."
He looked at Reenie.
"What are these? What do they mean?"
"You can speak on public band. No one will be surprised that this is new to you, or to me for that matter. Remember, we're just a couple of backwoods boys from Nigeria come to the virtual big city to see the sights." She changed over. "I suppose these are sensations that they simulate. Eddie, I mean that fellow we know, told us that they could give you sensory experiences your equipment wasn't wired for. Or they claim they can.
What should we do now?"
In the midst of the immense room, the Bushman's small sim looked even smaller, as though squeezed by the very weight of clamor and movement.
"Where do you wish to go?"
"I'm thinking."
She stared at the fiery letters hanging before them, a curtain of words that offered little privacy and no protection.
"I'd like it to be a little less noisy, actually, if we can afford it, that is."
It was still the same booth, but its colors had become muted earth tones, and it now sat in a small room along the quiet gallery. The arched doorway looked out on a wide blue pool set in the middle of stone cloisters.
"This is beautiful," said Habu, "and we came here just like that."
He snapped his sim fingers, but they made no noise.
"And the money is flowing out of our account just like that, too. This has to be the only club in the VR world where it costs less to rent a back room than to turn the noise down at your table. I suppose they want to encourage people to use the services."
Reenie straightened herself. The pool was mesmerizing. Drops fell from the mossy ceiling, making circular ripples that spread and overlapped, throwing blurry reflections back against the torchlit walls.
"I want to look around. I want to see what the rest of this place is like.
Can we afford to?"
She flicked to private band.
"I put some credits in the account that goes with this alias, but not many. They don't pay teachers that well. But we're only paying for this because we requested it. If we just wander around, well, I think they have to warn us before they charge our account."
Habu's face stretched in a sim smile.
"You think the people who own this place capable of many things, but you do not suspect them of cheating their customers?"
Reenie didn't like discussing what she thought them capable of, even on private band.
"No one stays in business if they cheat everybody. That's a fact. Even one of those Broderbund-owned clubs on the Victoria Embankment. They may take a bit off the top and deal to charge heads and drug addicts in the back, but they still have to keep up pretenses."
She stood and switched back over.
"Come on, let's have a look around."
As she and Habu stepped through the arch onto the walkway that ringed the pool, a light began to glow deep beneath the placid waters.
"That way," She moved toward it. But Khabu took a step after her, then stopped. It's all illusion. Remember that. And unless they've abandoned the universal VR interface symbols, that shows us the way out. She took another step and hesitated, then bent her knees and dove. The descent took a long time. Back at the Poly, her real body was being held horizontally in harness, so she had no physical sensation of falling. But here in the quiet gallery, she saw the glowing blue translucence come up to meet her, then saw her own splash create a vortex of bubbles around her. A circle of light glowed in the deeps. She headed toward it. A moment later, Khabu was beside her. Unlike Rini, who had mimicked the head-forward, arms-outstretched posture of a diver, he sank downward while standing upright. "What?" he began, then laughed. "We can talk." "It's not water, and those aren't fish." Khabu chortled again as a great cloud of shimmering forms surrounded them, tails flicking, fins whirring like tiny propellers. One, its scales striped in bold patterns of black, yellow, and red, swam backward in front of the bushman, its nose almost touching his. "Wonderful," he said, and reached toward it. The fish spun and darted away. The doorway still glowed, but the water around them seemed to be getting darker. They had moved through into some other level of the pool, or rather of the simulation. Rini could see what looked like seafloor below, rocks and white sand and waving forests of kelp. She even thought she saw a glimpse of something almost human sheltering in the forest's shadow-tangled depths, something with hands and fingers and bright eyes, but with the muscular tail of an ocean predator. Behind the splashing noises pumped into her earplugs was a deeper noise, a kind of singing. She found it disturbing. With a gesture, she hurried them to the gleaming exit. Up close, the ring was revealed to be a wreath of shining circles, each a different color. "Pick one," she told Khabu. He gestured, and the red ring glowed more brightly. A calm, genderless voice murmured, "Inferno and other lower chambers," into their ears. Khabu glanced at her. She nodded despite the sudden tingle of unease up the back of her neck. That would be the kind of place that would lure young boys like Stephen. Khabu touched the ring again, and the whole wreath of circles turned molten red, then expanded, flowing over and past them so that for a moment they were in a tunnel of crimson light. When the glare had faded, they were still underwater, although it now had a murkier cast. Rini at first thought the gateway had malfunctioned. "Up there," said Khabu, pointing. Far above them hung another circle of light. This one a solid disk of red like a dying sun. "That is what the sky looks like from deep beneath the water." He sounded a little breathless. "Then let's go." She wondered briefly what Khabu, a native of the shallow delta rivers and marshes, knew about deep water, then dismissed it. Maybe he'd been swimming in the Durban public pools. They rose toward the red light, floating through more seaweed forests. These were black and thorny, drifting clumps of water brambles that sometimes blocked their view of the circle entirely, and cast them into a strange undersea twilight. The water was cloudy, agitated by the steam vents which bubbled on the jagged ocean floor below them. All sign of where they had entered was gone, although she felt sure that if she and Khabu reversed direction, some indication of the route back into the quiet gallery pool would appear. She fingered one of the barbed strands of kelp, marveling anew at how its rough, rubbery texture could be manufactured from unphysical numbers. And yet, when transmitted to the tactors, the force feedback sensors in the glove of her swimsuit give every impression of palpable existence. Khabu reached out and snatched at her arm, jerking her sideways. "See?" He sounded genuinely panicked. She looked down, following his pointing finger. Something vast and dark was moving in the steaming depths. Rini could vaguely make out a smooth back and a strangely elongated head that seemed too big for the body, sliding along the rocky bottom near the spot where they had entered. The creature looked like some cross between a shark and a crocodile, but was far larger than either. The long, cylindrical body disappeared into the murk a dozen yards behind the questing muzzle. "It smells us!" She took his hand in hers and squeezed. "It's not real," she said firmly, although her own heart was beating very fast. The thing had ceased nosing at the vents and had begun lazily to move upward, its rising circular path taking it out of sight for the moment. She changed to private band. "Khabu, feel my hand? That's my real hand under my glove. Our bodies are in the harness room at the Poly. Remember that.
The eyes of Khabu's Sim were shut tight. Weenie had seen this before. A terrifying experience in a high-quality simulation could be just as overwhelming as in real life. She kept a tight grip on her friend's hand and accelerated their eyes. Something huge rushed through the spot they had just occupied, immense and swift as a maglev train. Her heart lurched. She had a brief glimpse of a gaping mouth full of teeth and a glinting eye as big as her head. Then the dark, shiny body was passing endlessly beneath them. She added more speed to their upward movement, then chided herself for doing just what she had warned Khabu against, using RL logic.
Just jump out, you fool. This isn't water, so you don't have to swim. Simulation or not, do you really want to find out what happens when that thing catches people?
She gestured with her free hand, and the red disk expanded dramatically. The surface seemed to fling itself down toward them. An instant later, they were bobbing on a wide and unsettled lake in a chaos of steam and red rain. Still caught up in the experience, Khabu floundered, thrashing his arms in an attempt to stay afloat, though at that moment Rini's control, rather than his own movements, determined his position. A great shiny hump broke the surface, moving rapidly toward them. Rini squeezed Khabu's hand again and moved them instantaneously to the lakeshore, 200 yards distant, but there was no shore. The crimson-lit water splashed against black basalt walls and then flowed up, hissing and boiling in great sheets to the stalactite-studded ceiling, before drizzling back down in a continuous smoking rain. Almost blinded, Rini and Khabu hung in place at the lake's edge, being violently bumped against painfully well-simulated stone. The hump splashed up into view again, and this time kept rising until the head towered above the roiling steam as it wove from side to side, searching for its prey. Rini bobbed in place for a moment, stunned. What she had thought was a gigantic body was only the thing's neck. The head moved closer, sluicing water like a dredging crane.
Leviathan,
she thought, remembering her mother's Bible readings, and felt a moment of superstitious fear, followed by a wave of hysterical mirth at the thought that a simple VR entertainment should surprise her so badly. The laughter died when Khabu's hands clutched at her shoulders and neck. Her friend was panicking.
"It's not real!"
she shouted, trying to make herself heard over the roar of the boiling waters and the bubbling wheeze of the approaching beast. But the bushman was caught up in his own private terror, and did not hear her. The vast maw opened, looming through the spattering rain. Weenie contemplated pulling the plug on the whole expedition, but they had learned nothing yet. Alarming though it was, this sort of thing was a roller coaster ride for kids like Stephen. Whatever had struck him down was nothing so obvious. The walls of the great cavern were covered with upward-flowing cataracts, but there were dozens of places where crimson light gleamed through the sheets of water as though there were open spaces beyond. Weenie picked one at random and moved them to it, even as the beast plunged its head downward, snapping at the emptiness where they had floated a moment before. As they sped toward the glowing spot, Weenie saw that the cavern walls were lined with human forms, mouths agape, all writhing slowly just beneath the churning waters, as though they had been partially absorbed by the stone. Fingers pushed through the cataracts, clawing toward her. The ceiling-bound water frothed from the stretching hands and dripped upward like strings of floating jewels. Rini and Khabu splashed through a curtain of water and fell forward onto a stone walkway as Leviathan's disappointed bellow shook the walls.
"Inferno," said Rini. "They're playing games, that's all. It's supposed to be hell."
Khabu still trembled. She could feel his shoulders shaking beneath her hand, but had ceased thrashing. The face of his sim was inadequate to express what she guessed was going on behind it.
"I am ashamed," he said at last. "I have behaved badly." "Nonsense."
Her reply was purposefully swift.
"It frightened me, and I do this for a living."
Which was not quite true. Very few of the VR environments she frequented had attractions of quite this order. But she didn't want the small man's spirit broken.
"Join me on the other band. That thing gives you some kind of idea of the programming and processing power they've got here, doesn't it?"
Khabu would not be so easily mollified.
"I could not stop myself. That is why I am ashamed. I knew it was not real, Rini.
I would not forget your teachings so easily. But when I was a child, a crocodile took me, and another took my cousin. I pulled free because it had a poor grip. I have the scars on my upper arm and shoulder still. But my cousin was not so lucky. When that crocodile was found and killed some days later, we found him in its belly, half dissolved and white as milk.
Rini shuddered. Don't blame yourself. God, I wish you'd told me about that before I dragged you into the pool. That's where VR can cause harm, and no one disputes it, where it touches on phobias or childhood fears. But because it's a controlled environment, they use it to cure those fears, too.
I do not feel cured, said Khabu miserably.
No, I'm not surprised. She squeezed his arm again,
then got to her feet. Her muscles were sore, just from the tension alone, she guessed. That and the pummeling Khabu had unwittingly given her.
Come on. We've burned an hour or so of our time already, and we've barely seen anything.
Where are we? He, too, straightened and stood, then stopped as a sudden idea struck him. Do we have to go out the same way when we leave? Rini laughed.
We most certainly do not. As a matter of fact, we can pull out directly any time we want. All you have to do is make the exit command, remember?
I do now. The corridor had been designed to carry on the motif of the boiling lake. The walls were the same black igneous stone, rough to the touch and dreary to look at. A sourceless red light suffused everything.
We could wander aimlessly, she said, or we can be a little more scientific about this.
She paused for a moment, but saw nothing that looked suggestive.
Options,
she said loudly and clearly. A tracery of burning lines appeared on the wall beside them. She studied the list, many of which were unpleasantly suggestive, and picked one of the most neutral.
Stairs.
The corridor wavered, then dropped away before them like water running down a drain. They stood on a landing in the middle of a wide, curving staircase that stretched away above and below, each step a massive slab of glossy black stone. For an instant they were alone. Then the air flickered, and they were surrounded by pale shapes.
"By my ancestors!" breathed Khabu.
Hundreds of ghostly figures filled the stairwell, some trudging wearily, many burdened by heavy bags or other burdens. Others, less substantial, floated in tatters above the steps like mist. Rini saw a variety of ancient costumes from many cultures, and heard a whispering babble of different tongues, as though these shades were meant to represent a cross-section of human history. She gestured to raise the sound on her earplugs, but still could not quite understand any of them.
"More lost souls," she said. "I wonder if someone is trying to send us a message. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," or something like that.
Khabu looked uncomfortable as he watched a beautiful Asian woman float past, her weeping head cradled carefully between the stumps of her wrists. "What shall we do now?" he asked.
"Go down."
It seemed obvious.
"You have to go down before you can come out. That's how these things always work."
"Ah!" Khabu turned toward her, a sudden smile stretching his simulated face. "Such wisdom is not easily come by, Rini. I am impressed." She stared at him for a moment. She had been talking about the endless dungeon games she had played as an et-girl, but she wasn't quite sure what he meant.
"Come on, then."
She wondered at first whether there would be any resistance, or at least any scenarios to be played out. But the spirits of the staircase only eddied past on either side, as murmurously harmless as pigeons. One, a gnarled old man who wore nothing but a loincloth, stood stationary in the middle of the staircase, silently shaking with laughter or tears. Rini tried to walk around him, but his sudden convulsive movement brought him against her elbow. He instantly dissolved into smoky wisps, then reformed farther up the stairs, still bent, still shaking. They walked for almost half an hour, companioned only by simulations of the restless dead. The staircase seemed endless, and Rini was considering choosing one of the doorways that led off each landing when she heard a voice cutting through the unhappy burble of the phantoms.
"Like a she-dog, breathing hard, growling, foam on her lips. You shall see."
The remark was followed by a chorus of raucous laughter. Rini and Khabu rounded a bend. On the landing before them stood four men, all quite real, at least compared to the phantom bystanders. Three of them were dark-skinned, dark-haired demigods, tall and almost impossibly handsome. The fourth was not quite as tall, but monstrously bulky, as though someone had dressed a hippopotamus in a white suit and given it a round, bald human head. Although his back was to them, and their approach made no sound, the fat man turned to Rini and Khabu immediately. Rini felt the swift examination by his small, bright eyes almost physically, like a series of probing finger jabs.
"Ah, hello. Are you enjoying yourselves, gentlemen?"
His voice was a work of genius, deep, buttery tones like a viola da gamba.
"Yes, thank you."
She kept a hand on Habu's shoulder, uncertain.
"Is this your first time in the world-renowned Mr. Jay's?"
asked the fat man.
"Come, I am certain that it is. No need to be ashamed. You must join us, for I know all the ins and outs of this strange and wonderful place. I am Strimbello."
He pushed the tip of his blunt jaw toward his breastbone in a minimal bow. His chins flattened and bulged like gills.
"Pleased to meet you," Rini said. "I am Mr. Otepi, and this is my business associate, Mr. Wande."
"You are from Africa. Splendid, splendid."
Strimbello beamed, as though Africa were a clever trick she and Khabu had just performed.
"My other friends, what a day for new friends this has been, are from the Indian subcontinent, Madras, to be specific. Please, may I introduce you to the brothers Pavamana?"
His three companions gave fractional nods. They were practically triplets, or at least their sims were nearly identical. A lot of money had been spent on their handsome VR bodies. Rini decided that it was probably overcompensation. In RL, the Pavamana brothers were doubtless pockmarked and sunken-chested.
"Pleased to meet you,"
she said. Khabu echoed her.
"And I was just taking these excellent fellows to see some of the Inferno's more select attractions."
Strimbello lowered his voice and winked. He had more than a little of the carnival barker about him.
"Would you care to join us?"
Rini suddenly remembered that Stephen had mentioned a fat man. Her heartbeat grew swifter. Could it all happen so quickly? So easily? But if opportunity was here, so was danger.
"You are very kind."
She and Khabu shared a glance as they fell into step behind the other group. Rini lifted a finger to her lips, warning him not to say anything, even on private band. If this man was part of the inner circle of Mr. Jay's, it would be folly to assume anything about his capabilities. As they floated down the great staircase, Strimbello seemed uninterested in arriviste pursuits like walking. The fat man regaled them with stories about the various ghosts, or the people the ghosts represented. One of them, a Frankish knight from the Crusades, had been cuckolded in an admirably devious manner, at which even Rini and Khabu had to laugh. Without changing tone, Strimbello then described what had happened afterward, and pointed out the two legless, armless figures worming along the stairs several paces behind the armored phantom. Rini felt sick. The fat man lifted his broad arms and raised his hands, palms up. The whole company suddenly floated away from the staircase and around another bend in the cavern wall, which abruptly dropped away. They were hanging above a great emptiness, a miles-deep well. The stairway spiraled down around its perimeter, vanishing in the dim red glow far beneath them.
"Too slow," Strimbello said, "and there is much, much to show you."
He gestured again, and they were falling. Rini felt her stomach drop alarmingly. The visuals were good, but not that good, surely. Suspended in her harness, and experiencing everything through the senses of her low-order sim, she should not be feeling this swift drop in such a visceral way. Beside her, Khabu had spread his arms as though to slow his descent. He looked slightly nervous, but there was a determined set to his narrow jaw that made Rini feel better. The little man was holding up well.
"We will, of course, land quite safely."
Strimbello's round head seemed almost to blink like a light bulb as the alternating levels of darkness and light strobed past.
"I hope I don't sound patronizing. Mr. Otepi, perhaps you have enjoyed such virtual experiences before."
"Nothing like this,"
said Rini truthfully. Their fall ended.
although they still hung in mid-air with a bottomless depth of well below them. At Strimbello's magisterial gesture, they slid sideways through nothingness and alighted on one of the levels that ringed the pit like theater balconies. The Pavamana brothers grinned and pointed at the passers-by. Their mouths moved without sound as they conversed on their own private band. Doors were open all along the curving promenade, spilling noise and color and the sound of many voices and many languages, laughter, screams, and unintelligible rhythmic chanting. A variety of Sims, mostly male, Rini could not help noticing, she suspected the few female shapes were part of the entertainment, moved in and out of the doorways and down the alleyways that radiated out from the central well. Some were embodied as handsomely as the Pavamana brothers, but many wore only the most basic forms. Small, gray, and almost faceless, they scuttled among their shining brothers like the pathetic damned. Strimbello suddenly took her by the arm. His vast hand printed itself so powerfully on her tactors that she winced.
"Come, come," he said. "It is time to see some of what you came here for. Perhaps the Yellow Room?"
"Oh, yes," one of the Pavamanas said. The other two nodded excitedly. "We have been told very much about that place."
"It is justifiably famous,"
said the fat man. He turned to Rini and Habu, his Sim face a perfect representation of shrewd humor.
"And you are not to worry at the expense, my new friends. I am well known here. My credit is good. Yes, you will come."
Rini hesitated, then nodded.
"So be it."
Strimbello waved his hand, and the promenade seemed to bend around them. A moment later they were in a long, low-ceilinged room, lit in various unpleasant shades of ochre and acid lemon. Throbbing music filled Rini's ears, a monotonous percussive thumping. The fat man was still gripping her arm firmly. She had to struggle to turn and look for Habu. Her friend was behind the Pavamanas, staring around the crowded room. The same mix of high and low-quality Sims that filled the promenade lined the tables of the Yellow Room, bellowing cheerfully at the stage which filled one end of the room, pounding with their fists until virtual crockery rolled and shattered on the floor. The bilious light gave their faces a feverish look. A woman, or what appeared to be a woman, Rini reminded herself, stood on the stage doing a jerky striptease timed to the swiftly lurching music. Rini was briefly reassured to see something so old-fashioned in its benign naughtiness, until she realized that what the woman was peeling off was not clothing, but skin. Already a ballet skirt of translucent, paper-thin, red-spotted flesh dangled from her hips. Worst of all was the look of resigned misery on the woman's... No, the Sims, Rini reminded herself, slack face. Unable to watch, Rini looked around again for Habu. She could see the top of his head past the Pavamanas, who were bobbing and elbowing each other like a slapstick comedy team. She stole another glance at the stage, but the wincing performer was now revealing the first layers of muscle flexing across her stomach. So Rini concentrated on the crowd instead. That did little to relieve her growing sense of claustrophobic discomfort. The simuloid faces of the audience were all wide, soulless eyes and gaping mouths. This was indeed the Inferno. A movement at the edge of her vision caught her attention. She thought Strimbello had been watching her. But when she turned, he appeared to be engrossed in the performance, his head nodding as if in proprietary approval, a tight smile pulling at the corners of his wide, wide mouth. Did he suspect somehow that she and Habu were not what they professed to be? How could he? They had done nothing unusual, and she had worked very hard on their aliases. But whatever he thought of them, he made her terribly uncomfortable. Whoever or whatever lived behind those small, hard eyes would be a very dangerous enemy. The throbbing music died. Rini turned back to the stage as a blare of horns signaled the departure of the stripper. A few desultory hand claps followed her as she limped toward the back of the stage, trailing a bridal train of tattered, glistening flesh. A deep orchestral hum signaled the next act. Strimbello leaned his huge head near.
"Do you understand French, Mr. Otepi? This is what you would call la spécialité de la maison." the Yellow Room's signature attraction.
He wrapped a large hand around her arm again and gave her a little shake.
You are of legal age, are you not?
He laughed suddenly, revealing broad, flat teeth.
Of course you are. Just my little joke.
Rini sought Khabu, a bit desperately this time. They had to think about getting away from this man soon. But her friend was hidden by the three Pavamanas, who had leaned forward in unison to watch the stage. False faces rapped. The deep rumble of the music changed, taking on a processional air.